Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 979. Nazism, anti-gay and anti-feminist propaganda, and the Fritz Haarmann incident. This is being recorded on October 10th of the year 2017. We've been dipping back into the archives for a couple of months, or the better part of that. And in the wake of not only the shooting in Las Vegas, but the Trump administration's anti-feminist and anti-gay actions and propaganda, I thought that going back into the archives to February 28th, to the miscellaneous archive show, The Pink Triangle, would be worthwhile. I do not think that the comparisons are exact, but noting the galvanizing effect or hypnotizing effect on the public of the shooting in Las Vegas, about which there remain many unanswered questions, but the effect on the public of that incident, and also, again, the Trump administration's moves and propaganda against gays and women slash feminists invites a comparison with the way Nazism behaved in Weimar and Nazi Germany. The following was recorded almost 30 years ago on February 28th of 1988. And in addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my charming and very capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, whose assistance was critical to the realization of the archive shows.
All right, we're going to be doing probably the, well, not probably, definitely, the vast majority of our work tonight from a book called The Pink Triangle. The book is subheaded The Nazi War Against Homosexuals. It's written by Richard Plant, P-L-A-N-T, and published by Henry Holt and Company of New York. And this book was the one that Andy provided for us, and we want to give him credit for that.
Mm-hmm. It's also got a nice write-up. People may be familiar with it. It came out to considerable critical acclaim just a couple of years ago.
Anyway, now we are talking about, again, I'm sure that there are people among our audience who are fairly new, and some of the things that we talk about very offhandedly may not be familiar to you. For those of you who are not familiar with the term Weimar Republic, it's spelled W-E-I-M-A-R. The Weimar Republic was the republic that eventually gave way, and one might point out, by elections rather than by an actual military takeover, but it gave way through elections to Hitler's initially elected and constitutional government in Germany, National Socialist Government. But the Weimar Republic was itself a tenuous experiment in democracy in a Germany that had not had much experience of that in some time. And it was only, in and of itself, was only able to happen after the revolution that followed the atrocious events of World War I had been put down very forcefully. We'll probably talk about that as well, because that was one of the early times in which provocation became a way of life for the German General Staff. Anyway, so we are talking about the Weimar Republic, which pretty much officially came to an end with the election of Hitler and his people.
Right. Now, again, for a variety of reasons, which we're not going to go into here, in the book, Plant traces in synoptic form the history of attitudes towards homosexuality in Germany, in the various parts of Germany, for a variety of reasons which we don't have the time to go into. Certain parts of Germany had developed relatively liberal attitudes towards homosexuality. The relatively liberal attitude of King Frederick II of Prussia had a lot to do with it. Other parts of Germany were very, very reactionary indeed. Traditional German conservatism, and indeed the overall German attitude had been very, very conservative, and with a legal paragraph called Paragraph 175, homosexuality was illegal. However, again, for a variety of reasons, during the Weimar Republic, a fairly liberal attitude toward homosexuality had evolved for historical reasons, which Plant goes into, but we haven't got the time to.
All right, reading from Robert Plant's book, The Pink Triangle, which we'll be reading from more than anything else tonight. During the Weimar Republic, the homosexual subculture had managed an uneasy coexistence with the larger heterosexual society surrounding it. Of course, those in the spotlight, famous actors, designers, dancers, doctors, politicians, directors, and lawyers, had to live with a certain amount of abuse. But many had acquired power, money, and even connections to the Weimar government, which served as protection. The average gay man could live unnoticed and undisturbed unless he fell victim to police entrapment or blackmail. The average lesbian enjoyed a kind of legal immunity. During the Weimar years, organized lesbian costume balls were held. Luxurious lesbian bars and nightclubs flourished. Their owners never feared a police raid. The reason? Neither the Second German Empire nor the Weimar Republic had ever promulgated laws forbidding or punishing sexual acts between women. Lesbian magazines enjoyed healthy circulation, some even featuring personal ads, and a few lesbian plays achieved widespread popularity. But the sexual tolerance so often associated with the Weimar Republic began to disappear as rapidly as Germany's economy began to crumble. The unemployed are generally less tolerant of contragenics. Contragenics is a term that Plant uses frequently, and he's just saying somebody who goes against the norm in this case, because he expands it later to include, not from his own way of thinking, but from the Nazi way of thinking.
An outgroup, basically.
An outgroup. He expands it later to include the Jews, the communists, the liberals, etc. Anyway, as he says, the unemployed are generally less tolerant of contragenics, and this is very true. We'll underscore that. We'll get back to it. Germany, it must be remembered, had never been an ethnically pluralistic society. Almost all German churches were state churches. There were no large ethnic groups or religious sects other than the Jews, the Gypsies, and the Jehovah's Witnesses, the latter relatively small in number. Homosexuals were an obvious, if largely invisible, scapegoat. The years from 1929 to the end of the Weimar Republic were years of mounting tension. The Brownshirts, or SA, under the leadership of Ernst Röhm, who was himself homosexual and would later be the target of Hitler's wrath, became even more brutal and more repressively efficient. Hitler had promised Germany's youth life as an endless military parade, replete with dashing insignia, badges, and banners. He invented special ranks for SA recruits and later for the SS. He proffered the vision of a brave, sunny world of soldiering for those who had given up hope. His enemies, he threatened, with war and extinction. They would be eliminated, quote, ruthlessly, his favorite word, and, quote, heads would roll. His various adversaries were united in nothing but blindness. Only when it was too late did some grasp that Hitler's program of wholesale destruction would indeed be carried out, its scope widening year after year. The initial misreading of the implications of the Nazis' policy of systematic violence was shared by almost all of those who were their victims. Union leaders, shrewd politicians of the center and the right, Marxists, Jewish scientists, writers, lawyers, and of course, homosexuals of all professions and educational levels. To be sure, a small minority did read the omens correctly and managed to leave Germany before it was too late, but many stayed behind to face their doom uncomprehendingly. Now, again, just to underscore that point, he said the unemployed are not very tolerant of contragenics. When you're talking about outgroups, of course, this has been a major theme of our broadcast. One of the reasons, of course, because Ronald Reagan rose to prominence on the back of the worst recession that the United States had been in for a long time.
At least since Richard Nixon had been in office.
And, of course, with the rise of Ronald Reagan went a not necessarily causative rise of violence against racial minority groups, against homosexuals, against a variety of other groups. The reason I say not necessarily causative, certainly some of it, as we have discussed on this broadcast, has been directly caused by the Reagan administration and their tools and cronies. However, also there have been other elements of it that have been caused merely by the example of the Reagan administration. Plus, thirdly, and the part that's not necessarily causative to the Reagan administration, a lot of this stuff was starting at the time the Reagan administration was making its bid for elected power. because of the climate in the United States. Again, partially having to do with economics, with frustration over the lack of control. America used to be a great nation. What happened to us? Again, very similar to Germany after World War I. For a while, Germany had bestrode the earth like a colossus. Now they were a weak and pitiful, helpless giant, and people were looking for things to blame, for people to blame, for groups to blame. And we see that repeated ad infinitum, ad nauseum in the United States these days.
Now, again, bear in mind the relatively tolerant climate of Weimar Germany towards homosexuals of both sexes. Now, it is against the background of this climate that we're going to take a look at Magnus Hirschfeld, the real pioneer of the nascent gay rights movement in Weimar Germany. Returning to The Pink Triangle by Richard Plant. It is in this context that the successes and failures of the homosexual rights movement in Germany must be measured. The movement began long before World War I during the reign of Kaiser Wilhelm II, but didn't assume the proportions of a significant reform movement until the arrival of Magnus Hirschfeld, 1868 through 1935. His name, by the way, is M-A-G-N-U-S, last name H-I-R-S-C-H-F-E-L-D. It would be hard to overestimate Hirschfeld's importance. The attacks on his person and on his life's work anticipate the wholesale horror that was to be unleashed once Hitler had consolidated his rule. Hirschfeld, a Jew, a homosexual, and a physician, was a man possessed of enormous energy, imagination, and ambition. He became the leader of several psychological and medical organizations, the founder of a unique institute for sexual research, and the organizer of numerous international congresses dedicated to research on sexual matters and to the promotion of policies that would lead to an acceptance of homosexuals by society. In his celebrated study, Homosexuality in Men and Women, Hirschfeld optimistically declared that 90% of the German people would vote to repeal the nation's anti-homosexual laws if only they had a chance to learn the truth. His optimism would later prove to be unfounded even after Hitler's defeat in 1945. Hirschfeld's motto was, "Justice through knowledge," unquote. He was not alone in his belief that progress could be made through the exercise of reason. Other doctors and psychiatrists, such as Richard von Krafft-Ebing, Albert Mohl, and Alfred Adler, shared this belief even as they contested Hirschfeld's ideas while respecting his research. Consumed by a kind of missionary zeal, Hirschfeld wrote book after book, polemic after polemic, pamphlet after pamphlet. His total output, nearly 200 titles, is staggering. Natural Laws of Love, 1912, Homosexuality in Men and Women, 1918-20, Sexual Pathology, 3 volumes, 1920, The Science of Sexology, 1920, and Sexual Knowledge, 5 volumes published from 1926 to 1930, are his major works. Most of the books were quite lengthy. For example, the second edition of Homosexuality in Men and Women stretches to more than 1,000 pages. In addition, Hirschfeld composed scores of articles, book reviews, political pamphlets, and petitions to government agencies. He also founded the Yearbook for Intersexual Variants, which he edited until 1923 and was published, with a few interruptions, until 1932-33. The yearbooks addressed legal, historical, medical, and anthropological aspects of homosexuality. They presented lengthy discussions with psychiatrists who disputed Hirschfeld's work. For a long time, Hirschfeld had believed that homosexuals formed a third sex. He would abandon this notion in 1910. He considered the archetype of the totally masculine male and the totally feminine female as unchanging throughout history, a law of nature as firmly rooted in reality as the laws of mathematics. He was convinced that homosexuals constituted a biologically distinct gender, a human being between male and female. He devoted much thought to establishing fine differentiations within this third sex. The third sex thesis, however, would inadvertently help the Nazis in their crusade against homosexuals, as will be explained below. Hirschfeld repeatedly tried to reform Germany's laws, particularly the notorious paragraph 175. This national law, enacted in 1871, stipulated that, quote, "A male who indulges in criminally indecent activities with another male, or who allows himself to participate in such activities, will be punished with jail."
Continuing, later section. Fortunately, Hirschfeld found some unexpected allies. Let me start that sentence again. Fortunately, Hirschfeld found some unexpected allies in the women's emancipation movement. The most active organization was the League for the Protection of Maternity and Sexual Reform, founded in 1905. Its guiding spirit was Dr. Helene Stucker, or Stecker, S-T-O-E-C-K-E-R, from 1869 to 1943, an indefatigable organizer as unswervingly optimistic as Hirschfeld, who joined Hirschfeld's committee in order to squelch attempts at making sexual relations between women a criminal offense. And it says in parentheses, the laws were never passed. Stecker believed, and wrote in various articles, that it was senseless to punish homosexual acts. A bond was established between the women's movement and the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, which is Hirschfeld's group, when Stecker became one of the committee's directors. Nazi propagandists would later stress that activities for the emancipation of women and for the repeal of anti-homosexual laws were part of one indivisible conspiracy. This, of course, was rubbish. What was true was the rather sudden appearance around the turn of the century of a number of independent sexual reform movements, including the Movement for Women's Suffrage, which held its first big demonstration in Berlin in 1894. In the early 20s, a number of homosexual associations sprang up in Breslau, Frankfurt, Lübeck, and other large cities. Hirschfeld had tried, unsuccessfully, to unite them under one umbrella, or under one umbrella organization, but internecine squabbles made unity a mirage. Nevertheless, cooperation among some of the movements grew over time as natural affinities came to be recognized.
And again, obviously, this bears a strong similarity to many aspects of the contemporary feminist and gay rights movements. There has been a considerable intersection between and affinity between the two. So again, we're presenting this by way of pointing out the similarity between Weimar Germany and the situation today. Continuing with the Pink Triangle. Hirschfeld's triumphant moment may have arrived in September of 1921 when he organized the first Congress for Sexual Reform. Experts came from all over the world to discuss such topics as genetics, sexology, and the law. The Congress was such a success that Hirschfeld was emboldened to create the World League for Sexual Reform, which at its height claimed a membership of 130,000. Nobody has written more vividly about the Institute than Christopher Isherwood, especially in his memoir, Christopher and His Kind, 1976. For a time, Isherwood lived in one of the upper rooms of the Institute's buildings. Photographs in the Institute's collection depicting the sexual organs of hermaphrodites shocked him, as did the drawings of one of Hirschfeld's psychotic patients in which phalluses reigned and strange couplings took place. Isherwood reveals a more complicated reality than the one he had described earlier in Goodbye to Berlin, 1939, in which he presented a gravely distorted vision of a city peopled by rough working men charmed by the handsome writer from England. By the way, interrupting, of course, Christopher Isherwood's work, as I'm sure many of you are aware, served as the basis for the popular musical and movie Cabaret, which many people I would recommend seeing that if you can pick up the video cassette. Very relevant. Continuing. In 1976, Isherwood acknowledged certain brutal realities, that Hirschfeld had repeatedly been beaten up by right-wing thugs, and that he had barely escaped an assassination attempt in Vienna. What Isherwood doesn't mention is the abuse Hirschfeld suffered at the hands of the right-wing press whenever he lectured. After one physical assault, for example, a Nazi paper sneered, quote, "It is not without charm to know that Hirschfeld was so beaten that his eloquent mouth could never again be kissed by one of his disciples," unquote. Das Schwarze Korps, the official propaganda sheet of the SS, and Hitler's personal newspaper, the Völkische Beobachter, were particularly vicious. They usually varied three invectives in several combinations. Hirschfeld, the Jewish homosexual commie pervert masquerading as a scientist, seeks only one aim, to permit homosexuality to flourish, which would mean fewer babies, and thus the German nation would be weakened. However, neither the Nazi propaganda sheets nor the few liberal papers that took a more benevolent view of Hirschfeld had as much impact on the majority of Germans as did the mainstream yellow press. There, his institute was lumped together with transvestite nightclubs, houses of prostitution, gay bars, and general rot in Berlin. The capital was Sodom anyhow, it was said, a city where bureaucrats swindled decent people out of money, a city without a soul, a city controlled by Jews and perverts. Incidentally, I would add that Berlin was one of the areas in Germany that had a very liberal attitude towards homosexuals of both sexes. Also, note here the similarity between the way the Nazis used homosexuality. Hirschfeld, the leading figure of the gay rights movement in Weimar Germany, being both a Jew and a homosexual, also they, although it's not in this passage, a very liberal person politically, well, this was used to tar their opponents with the onus of sexuality, or of homosexuality, and again, they're unnerving reflections of this same kind of a pattern in today's society, where we see conservative Republicans, some of the more flamboyant of the religious evangelists, talking about the Democrats and the liberals as the purveyors of homosexuality and corruption and so forth. Again, continuing. People in small provincial towns came to loathe Berlin as a center of corruption. Whatever opinions they might have held about Hirschfeld's committee weren't helped by a clumsily produced film about homosexual blackmail, different from the others, released in 1919. It starred Conrad Veidt, or Veidt, I'm not sure how it's pronounced,
Veidt,
who became famous a year later for his portrayal of the somnambulist in the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and, in a small part, Magnus Hirschfeld himself. The film was banned in Munich, Stuttgart, and Vienna. In 1927, it was re-released, but Hirschfeld's part was cut out. Moreover, the problems of belonging to a third sex, unquote, must not have seemed very compelling to the vast majority of heterosexual Germans struggling to cope with unemployment and inflation. And now we're going to go into one of the most important parts of this book, a key apparent provocation which was used to defame the gay rights movement, to attribute liberal to join in the public's mind liberalism and homosexuality and murder. And again, this was used very cleverly by the Nazis, and as we're going to talk about, something which has unnerving reflections for contemporary America. This is the Fritz Haarmann case.
We're going to be continuing here from the Pink Triangle. The Fritz Haarmann that Dave refers to, the name is spelled H-A-A-R-M-A-N-N, just so you know. The film, however, was of minor importance for the homosexual rights movement compared with the shocking murders that occurred in Hanover in 1923 and 1924, culminating in the trial of a certain Fritz Haarmann. Simply put, it was a disaster for Hirschfeld's and the committee's efforts to liberalize the law. It splintered the movement irreparably, fed every prejudice against homosexuality, and provided new fodder for conservative adversaries of legal sex reform. In addition, it pitted the Social Democrats unwillingly against the Communist Party. Most historians of the Weimar Republic have neglected the trial, but Haarmann dominated the headlines for months, and the passions he aroused did much to weaken the struggle to abolish paragraph 175. The trial took place during July 1924 in Hanover, a medium-sized northern city, a place known as much for its black market as for its huge number of prostitutes and hustlers. Interestingly enough, Hanover had been the birthplace of Karl Heinrich Ulrichs, who, it will be recalled, had been among the first in the 19th century to urge greater tolerance toward homosexuals, writing over the course of many years a dozen books that were collectively titled Researches on the Riddle of Love Between Men. Until 1869, when the stringent Prussian penal code was extended, Hanover was one of the handful of German states that did not punish homosexuality. Fritz Haarmann, a homosexual small-time crook who had spent most of his life in and out of insane asylums and prisons, sold second-hand clothing and jewelry and third-rate food, mostly meat. He also acted as a police informer, which for a time saved him from being suspected of a series of spectacular murders. It was Harman's habit to pick up, quote, for interrogation, unquote, destitute youngsters at Hanover's railroad station or some other center of the black market. He then took them to one of his ever-changing slum apartments near the banks of the Leine River. He murdered some, but others he let go. Of those he killed, he cut off head and limbs, severed the flesh, fed it through a grinder, and sold it in small, well-wrapped packages as horse meat. The black market absorbed all this until too many skulls and bones were found washed up on the banks of the Leine River. As more details were uncovered, it emerged that Haarmann not only carried a police badge, but had founded his own phony detective agency. Haarmann, though a psychopath of low intelligence and no grasp of reality, did possess a shrewd talent for deceit, and he had actually assisted the police in solving several crimes. He confessed readily. He did not recall details, names, faces. He remembered that sometimes, overcome by sexual rage, he bit through his victims' throats, and thus ancient tales of werewolves and vampires were thrown into the legal proceedings. Altogether, criminologists and pathologists reconstructed 147 cases of missing persons. Hirschfeld was called from Berlin as an expert witness, but he never wrote about the case. Conservative businessman Friedrich Radziwiłł, head of the League for Human Rights, did. He sent a letter to the leading newspapers in which he strongly protested, quote, the yellow press, which tried to identify homosexuals with this feeble-minded criminal. The homosexual minority in our nation emphatically rejects these insulting remarks, which equate homosexuality with criminality, unquote. Harman admitted to 127 murders and asked to be executed. He alternated between crying and cajoling and pleaded insanity. The court sentenced him to death. Okay, before we go on here, I just want to put the idea in people's minds of the idea of a feeble-minded criminal who somehow managed to yet pull off incredible crimes for which an entire group of people are branded. And I'm going to let Dave read a little bit more, and then we'll talk about some similarities to another feeble-minded criminal that managed to turn up to the Nazis' aid and comfort a little later on.
Now, continuing with the Pink Triangle. Journalists were admonished to play everything down. The Hanover officials wanted no panic. Reporters were also encouraged not to investigate the role of the police. I'm going to repeat that last sentence again. Reporters were also encouraged not to investigate the role of the police. It was on this point that the communists unleashed an avalanche of criticism against the hated Social Democrats. The post of police commissioner of Hanover was held by Gustav Noske, G-U-S-T-A-V-N-O-S-K-E, who, years before, had beaten back left-wing demonstrators by using Reichswehr and Freikorps troops, or Free Corps troops. Originally, Gustav Noske was a Social Democrat, but he had acted with a vengeance that the radical labor rebels never forgave. He was hated as much as his superior, Karl Severing, S-E-V-E-R-I-N-G, the Prussian Minister of the Interior and also a Social Democrat. Altogether, Severing and Noske had put behind bars about 7,000 workers. When the local communist paper, the Niederösterreichische Arbeitszeitung, began to reveal the net of police connections Harman had established as a stool pigeon, its circulation jumped from 8,000 to 35,000. As soon as Noske returned from a vacation, he had the newspaper declared injurious to public safety and banned it. I'm going to read those last two sentences again. When the local communist paper, the Niederösterreichische Arbeiterzeitung began to reveal the net of police connections Harman had established as a stool pigeon, its circulation jumped from 8,000 to 35,000. As soon as Noske returned from a vacation, he had the newspaper declared injurious to public safety and banned it. Rather curious behavior there under the circumstances. Okay, now, again, we're affecting a few engineering difficulties so that we don't have our ID on the tape. Basically, the main points in this particular passage are several. There's several very important points. First of all, as Nip pointed out, the unlikelihood of a feeble-minded individual being able to pull off 127 murders of this type, even in an area which is undergoing the social chaos that Germany was in this historical period. Remember, 1924, which is when this is going on, 3 years after the founding of the Nazi Party, roughly, this was at the height, or the depth, perhaps, of the German inflation. Germany was completely ravaged economically. Still, it appears extremely unlikely that a true feeble-minded person would have been able to pull this off. It is more than a little enlightening that this person was not only a police informer, but apparently ran a network of other police informers, had his own phony detective agency, carried a police badge, and more revealing still is the official reaction when the communist paper began to highlight this. They shut the paper down, they encouraged reporters not to look into the role of the police, and still more significantly, perhaps, the police commissioner of Hanover at this time was a fellow named Gustav Noske. Now, Gustav Noske is a very, very important figure from the history of this period. Now, let's review just a little bit of the history of Weimar Germany so that what we're about to read here makes more sense. At the end of the First World War, due to a lot of things, that the terrible economic conditions imposed by a rigorous British naval blockade, the devastation of the war in the trenches to the population, and plus continuing political turmoil within Germany from the pre-war years, had created basically an untenable situation for the German people. When militarily, particularly because of the entry of the United States, the war became untenable for the high command, and when it was learned that in fact Erich von Ludendorff, the chief of the German chief of the German's general staff, was suing for peace, a revolution broke out in Germany. There were a series of left-wing uprisings for about a two-year period in Germany. Well, actually more than that, but a series of serious left-wing uprisings in Germany for a period of roughly a year and a half to 2 years, beginning roughly in November of 1918 and proceeding until late 1919. Now, in order to put down these abortive communist uprisings, the Social Democrats, who themselves were a relatively liberal group but who relied heavily on middle-class support, joined forces with the German military high command, and not only was the regular Reichswehr used to suppress these uprisings, but in particular, a series of volunteer military organizations were put together, and it was chiefly these volunteer military organizations, most importantly, the Free Corps, or Freikorps, that put down the abortive German uprisings. Later, as we looked at in a couple of our programs, Radio Free America number 10, also an old Hard Rain broadcast, which is still on file with Archives on Audio, we took a look at the Freikorps and the so-called Black Reichswehr, which resulted when the Freikorps, the Einwohnerwehren, the Civil Guards, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, the all-volunteer civil guards, were basically these organizations, although officially established by the Weimar government, remained in power even after they were officially disbanded. They functioned as an underground extension of the German military, and they were bitterly opposed to the Weimar Republic. They systematically assassinated not only the communists and leftists, but also all political opponents that could have stopped Adolf Hitler. Hitler's rise to power was essentially paved by the so-called Black Reichswehr, the Freikorps assassinations, okay? Now, interestingly enough, it was Gustav Noske who was in charge of the National Security Establishment in Weimar, Germany, and it was Gustav Noske, more than any other individual, who put together the Freikorps, the Einwohnerwehren, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, which wound up exterminating democracy in Germany. We're going to talk about Gustav Noske. This comes from a book called Paramilitary Politics in Weimar, Germany. It's by James M. Diehl, last name D-I-E-H-L. It's published by the Indiana University Press, and copyright, I believe, 1977. Let me find the title page. Yeah, copyright 1977, Indiana University Press, Bloomington and London, it says here. Now, of Gustav Noske and his role in forming the German volunteer military organizations, which wound up subverting democracy in Weimar, Germany, although they were pledged to defend it and formed initially to defend it, G. Diehl writes as follows. The decision of the Supreme Command during the final weeks of 1918 to cooperate with the government in the creation of a volunteer force was born of necessity, but the situation offered certain advantages. Since the new forces would be hired and paid for by the government, but directed by the Supreme Command, the latter would shape and control the new military force while at the same time avoiding direct responsibility. Adroitly capitalizing on the Social Democratic leader's fear of the left, the OHL, that's German Military High Command, got what it wanted. Government support for the creation of a volunteer force, plus a free hand in forming it. The withdrawal of the independent members of the Council of People's Representatives in late December, and the appointment of Gustav Noske as Minister in Charge of Military Affairs, greatly facilitated the growth of the volunteer system. Noske, a right-wing social democrat, shared Ebert's fear of the left and, like him, believed the best way to build a new military force was in cooperation with the old military authorities. With Noske's cooperation and support, the OHL's efforts to replace the rapidly disintegrating conscript army with a volunteer force soon bore fruit. It was these forces, recruited and led by former officers, that were to restore order in the Reich during the first half of 1919. The volunteer forces, which consisted of three types, Free Corps or Freikorps, Auxiliary Volunteer Units, Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, and Civil Guards, Einwohnerwehren, effectively restored order, but soon evolved into independent power factors outside the control of the government. By creating, or better, by supporting the creation of a system of volunteer forces and then failing to control it, the new government lost, or failed to achieve, an effective monopoly of armed force and sowed the seeds for the latter paramilitary activity that was to plague the Republic. Although the nature and type of activity of the three volunteer organizations differed, they shared one characteristic. All turned against the Republic. Less direct, but potentially of even greater danger to the Republic, was the manner in which they militarized the police mentality of those predominantly middle-class Germans who flocked to their colors.
continuing with paramilitary politics in Weimar Germany. Since the Reichswehr was still in its infancy, the Freikorps, or Freikorps, were probably the single most important power in Germany. Technically, the achievements of Noske and the Supreme Command had been extraordinary. From the shattered and dispirited remains of the defeated German Imperial Army, they had in the space of a few months forged an effective fighting force, which had restored order out of chaos and successfully defended the Ebert government from its enemies on the left. These technical achievements were accompanied by a legacy of brutality and bitterness, however, and were to have serious political and social consequences. Now, this is Gustav Noske. This is the man who started as the essentially the chief of police in Hanover, the legal authority in Hanover, where Fritz Haarmann had his reign of terror. Noske obviously got on the career fast track because he, as we've just detailed for you, wound up being in charge of the military forces of Weimar Germany when the various Free Corps and other, I guess what you'd have to call not only the street fighters, the death squads, were first put together.
Precisely, and the parallel with the death squads in Latin America formed by our own national security establishment, also the ones apparently working in the United States, is more than a little instructive here.
Indeed, and also just, again, to remain topical, the ones that are just even now as we speak being formed in the Philippines due to another executive fiat.
Before we go on to the social effects of the Haarmann case, and again, the key role of Gustav Noske in forming the Freikorps, which paved Hitler's rise to power, his role as police commissioner of Hanover, and the police were quite apparently running Fritz Haarmann, the man who killed 127 people, bears some unnerving similarities to what we've been looking at in a number of other shows for quite some time now. In a program we have on file with archives on audio called The Ultimate Evil, we looked at, among other things, connections of the Manson family with their horrible killings in Southern California and the Son of Sam killings in New York done by David Berkowitz, not only to explicit neo-Nazi organizations but also to some satanic cults as well. And we've speculated at length about satanic cults as, at least in some cases, fronts for national security activity. Again, our tape called The Ultimate Evil. We'll talk about that. Mae Russell, whose work we rely on heavily on this program, in many ways did some pioneering research with her study of organizations like the Manson family, the Symbionese Liberation Army, what she referred to as the California violences. Many of the horrible serial killers, the brutal, seemingly senseless murders which afflicted California under the governorship of Ronald Reagan. Recall, California really was not beset with these kinds of killings on a regular basis before then. There have been killers, including some serial killers, in all societies throughout time, but the sudden explosion of Manson family, zebra killer, Zodiac killer type activity was particularly characteristic of the Reagan administration. We've speculated, based on May's research, that in essence the Reagan administration in California could be looked at in a manner similar to the Spanish Civil War, in which many of the tactics which were later to prove so successful in Europe were in fact tried out on a small scale during the Spanish Civil War. We've speculated, and May has speculated, has gone on for many years, about the California violences as, in essence, a form of terrorism which later has proved very applicable to the society as a whole. Recall not only the hard links of the Manson family and to Nazism, but also the political connections. We talked about that in Radio Free America number 12, as well as The Ultimate Evil, but also in attempting to get a grasp on this kind of information. And by the way, I think I feel safe in speaking for NIF that we understand that new listeners to this program are going to have a real hard time with this kind of stuff. But again, we encourage people to reading. The reason I'm citing these references is not to prove how clever I am, but to enable people who want to pursue this to get the documentation, okay? But just look within yourselves and how people react to these kinds of things. It's not only scary and depressing, but it produces a basically conservative political trend in society. People just get this view that, hey, there are these nuts running around, these screwballs, you know, these angry whatevers, you know, be it, you know, hippies, blacks, or whatever, who are just ready to carve you into shish kebab. They get the feeling in particular that their children aren't safe, that something has to be, you know, we need law and order, we need strong police, we need a lot of jails, we need more rigorous courts. It really, even though it may not apparently have an ostensible political meaning, it is a very, very political phenomenon, and it benefits the political right. And we're looking not only at the Harmon case, but also by historical analogy, the California violences and many of the other things we've seen, these serial killings, which seem to be bedeviling the United States, I use the term advisedly, as basically analogs and as political provocations meant to foment political reaction in society.
Now, to go from the macro to the micro, first still at the macro level, or at least talking about the wider picture here in the United States today, those who think these things don't have an effect might think of the various serial killings that have gotten such play in the California newspapers over the last few years, the Archie Fain, the Hillside Strangler cases, the people of this ilk.
The guy who chopped off that gal's arms and now, and there was a huge hubbub.
I've forgotten his name, but I know exactly who you're speaking about, the one who was let out of prison and they couldn't find a place to keep him, and now his name has slipped my mind. But we might all notice, of course, what happened to the quote liberal unquote Supreme Court in the state of California, as has happened in another way with the once liberal national Supreme Court. It is no longer, in fact, a liberal Supreme Court. It is, in fact, a stacked conservative Supreme Court, both at the state and the national level. Now, back to the time that we're talking about. If we had only the evidence of the fact that this man, Fritz Harmon, was, although supposedly feeble-minded at the same time, was working for the police, running a string of informers, had a phony detective agency.
The police under Gustav Noske.
Yeah, the police under Gustav Noske, and pulled off something in the neighborhood of 120 to 150 murders. The real skeptics out there might be able to still be skeptical.
And not just murder, but he chopped people up and sold them as meat.
Yes, an enterprising, feeble-minded guy. Now, however, when we put this into the context of, the Nazis never wanted to miss a trick, and in a way it's sort of ironic that the communists used the Harmon case to tar the police with the epithet of homosexual in their own bid for power, because then later the communists themselves got sucked into the same trap. A man by the name of Martinus van der Lubbe supposedly burned down the Reichswehr. Martinus van der Lubbe was
Reichstag.
Thank you. Excuse me. Supposedly burned down the Reichstag. Van der Lubbe was supposed to be a communist. He was also another feeble-minded person who, it's very hard to believe that this man could have done this work, but the Nazis managed to string a large amount of their political victories onto this event, the burning of the Reichstag, by a, quote, feeble-minded communist.
Right. In fact, now, bear in mind, the Reichstag was the German parliament building. Hitler had been appointed chancellor by Hindenburg, and then he assumed office, I believe it was January 20th, 1933, and it was February 27th, 1933. Just coincidentally, the German parliament burns down. They blamed it on Martinus van der Lubbe, who was on the scene. Now, he was not only legally insane, he was also legally blind, which is interesting. Also interesting, Hermann Goering had a house immediately right beside the Reichstag, which just so happened to have a tunnel which joined it with the Reichstag building. He and the other top Nazi leadership appear on the steps of the burning Reichstag, blamed it on the communists, had a forceful march, and then used that as an excuse to suspend democratic leadership, democratic political process in Germany, declare themselves dictators to protect the republic from the communist menace. And then, interestingly enough, right at that time was when the formal crackdown on homosexuals in Germany came, along with a crackdown on everybody else.
Now, not to draw the net too wide, but I was just watching a broadcast on TV the other night called Television, which some of you may have seen, which was basically a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. But again, we saw the rather poignant scene of one Lee Harvey Oswald being brought out of police headquarters in Dallas, and reporters saying, you know, did you shoot the president? And Lee Harvey Oswald, the supposed megalomaniac assassin, saying, I didn't shoot anybody. And a moment later being shot himself, of course, and not being around to make those kind of protestations any longer. One thinks of Martinus van der Lubbe sitting around in a Nazi court, wondering how the heck did I get here, and what the heck am I being accused of?
We're going to go back to the Pink Triangle in a second, but one point that should be made, I think, also since Nitt brought that up, is that in Weimar Germany, as we looked at in a broadcast that's also on file with archives on audio called They Thought They Were Free, there were many people who tried to warn about the Freikorps killings, tried to warn about the coming of Hitler, what his policies would mean. Most people did not buy it, and in fact, today, people who engage in the kind of work that Nip and myself and Mae Brussel are in are referred to either as conspiracy theorists or paranoid. And the terms in Weimar Germany, they didn't have the, you know, the psychobabble hadn't reached the same state. They were called alarmists, not paranoid, and they were called conspiracy mongers, not conspiracy theorists, but yet another disgusting parallel.
All right. Now, again, so when we think about things like the Reichstag fire and other things, and we think about the rise of Gustav Noske, and then we look at the Fritz Haarmann case, and in the light of the, as we're going to see especially later on, in light of the eugenics theories of the Nazis, some of the utility of the Haarmann case to the Nazis pushing for power become apparent. We're going to read a little bit more from the Pink Triangle, and then I think we're going to take a break. Anyway, talking about right after and during the time of the Fritz Haarmann trial, the pitch of public hysteria mounted. Many mothers now panicked when their children did not return on time from school, which was all the more understandable because the police had begun arresting child murderers in other cities as well. In Berlin high schools, a grim ditty made the rounds. "Wait with patience, little mouse. Fritz will soon come to your house. With his axe so sharp and neat, he'll make you into red chopped meat." Hirschfeld's appearance as an expert during the Haarmann trial seems only to have deepened the public's animosity toward his committee. It infuriated the Nazis. That the main vehicles for sexual reform, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee and the Institute for Sexual Research, were founded by Magnus Hirschfeld, a social democrat, a Jew, and a homosexual, and that Kurt Hiller, his administrative successor, and many other members were Jewish and liberal, made it easy for Hitler's early followers to vilify all efforts to abolish paragraph 175. As early as 1920, Josef Goebbels' weekly Der Angriff had expressed its malevolence after Hirschfeld was beaten following a lecture in Munich. The newspaper praised the students for the, quote, sound thrashing administered to Hirschfeld. 7 years later, Wilhelm Frick, a lawyer, later famous for drafting the anti-Jewish Nuremberg laws in 1935, denounced the Social Democrats on the floor of the Reichstag. Quote, "Your party, at its last convention, has demanded the repeal of all laws concerning adultery and homosexuality, and you seem to believe that this will contribute to a moral regeneration of the German nation. We National Socialists are convinced, on the contrary, that men practicing unnatural lechery between men must be persecuted with utmost severity. Such vices will lead to the disintegration of the German people." When in 1929 the Social Democrats and the Communists had succeeded in getting a crucial parliamentary committee to vote in favor of bringing before the Reichstag a bill to strike down paragraph 175, Hitler's official newspaper wrote, quote, "We congratulate you, Mr. Hirschfeld, on the victory in committee, but don't think that we Germans will allow these laws to stand for a single day after we have come to power. Among the many evil instincts that characterize the Jewish race, one that is especially pernicious has to do with sexual relationships. The Jews are forever trying to propagandize sexual relations between siblings, men and animals, and men and men. We National Socialists will soon unmask and condemn them by law. These efforts are nothing but vulgar, perverted crimes, and we will punish them by banishment or hanging." Well, as we all know, banishment would have been lucky compared to what was done. We're going to talk more about that in a moment. I think one other thing that should be mentioned, in light of these things that we've been talking about and the effect on the body politic, sometimes in very subtle ways, of these kinds of activities. One of the big things that's gotten a lot of press lately, through no small amount due to the help of the fundamentalist Christian movement, is the issue of not only of child molestation but of child kidnapping in general. And I remember reading an article the other day where somebody was talking about the fact that there were figures being tossed around of 15,000, 20,000 children being kidnapped every year. These horrifying statistics. And, you know, of course, all the milk bottles and the Donahue shows and the milk carton pictures and the Donahue shows and the Oprah Winfrey shows and everybody talking about that. And it was actually an FBI agent, one of those treasures, an honest and sensible FBI agent. And he was saying, look, let's put it this way. You know, how many people do you know who've ever had a child kidnapped? He said 98% of all the child kidnappings are one parent, you know, a divorced parent snatching the kid. It goes down as a kidnapping, but everybody knows who's got the kid. You may not be able to find them immediately, but they're not molesters. They're parents. He said in reality there was something like, and I can't remember the exact figure, so I'm making it up here, but this is approximate. There was something like 25 to 75, somewhere in that number of unsolved kidnappings of children per year. Now, admittedly, no unsolved kidnapping of a child is a good thing, and many terrible things do happen to children. But when you consider that the average person in this country who doesn't bother to read the newspapers carefully hears things like 15,000, 20,000 children kidnapped, hears murder, torture, mutilation, satanic ritual stories thrown about left and right, it's no wonder that that we begin to see this kind of hysteria. And then when you link it to the AIDS hysteria, we have a genuine, frighteningly reactionary movement taking place.
Beyond that, in our discussion of the Temple of Set, which may very well be an intelligence front of sorts, the fact of the matter is that they do molest children. They do kidnap children. The numbers I'm not even going to begin to dispute, because I myself am not in a position to comment. But I do, one of the things that we've spoken about in connection with these satanic cults, one of the many strategic considerations is that it does, in fact, provide excellent grist for the mills of those reactionary Christians who want to exploit this sort of thing to try and drive people into their own ranks. And again, I think in addition to the blackmail and the other considerations we've talked about, desensitization to violence, that's something to think about. But again, the thing before, because we're going to break here in a second, keep in mind the Harmon case, the extent to which it panicked people, the extent to which it tarred the gay rights movement with this horrible, bloody stigma, and the extent to which it was used by the Nazis, to stigmatize their political opponents. Magnus Hirschfeld, the commie, Jew, homosexual pervert. You know, that again, that's the central point here, and of course, with champion of human rights, Gustav Noske, as the police commissioner, it shouldn't prove all that surprising that Hanover would be the site of this particular apparent provocation.
That's right. And one last thing, a lesson that we've all learned and talked about a great deal, is the whole fact of psychological warfare is it doesn't have to make sense. Once the linkage has been established, the reaction is there. It doesn't have to be logical. All you have to do is put pictures of political enemies on the front page next to pictures of headless corpses or under headlines that may have nothing to do with the story but suggest horrible things, mass murders, etc. All you have to do is make those kind of linkages in people's minds, and after a while the logic is totally unimportant. The damage has been done, and this is the lesson to learn.
Yeah, again, perhaps not coincidentally, we took a look at Michael Aquino and his background in psychological warfare. That is his specialty as a lieutenant colonel. And again, we speculated about the possibility of the Temple of Set as an intelligence front and perhaps also connected with the Process Umbrella Cult.
We're going to take a break for a few minutes, and when we come back, we will be continuing with this archive like One Step Beyond, talking about the rise and the short thriving and the eventual terrible destruction of the gay rights movement in Germany, and of course making connections to our own age as well, which is what we do best. And we will be the equivalent of like a Radio Free America broadcast, the special focus tonight being the gay liberation movement. Of course, gay was not a word, I don't think, that was used in Germany at that time, although it is a surprisingly it's a word of surprising longevity in terms of how long it's been used to describe homosexuality, not as recent as one might think. But anyway, talking about the homosexual political movement in Germany and how on one hand it itself was tragically snuffed out by the advent of Nazism, but for our purposes, of course, significantly how it was also used by the Nazis as yet another thing to hang around the necks of their those who would oppose them. Not only were you a Jew and a communist, you could be a Jew and a communist and a homosexual, and it was used to great advantage by the Nazis. And we've just been talking about the Fritz Haarmann case, Fritz Haarmann being the homosexual, supposedly feeble-minded murderer who also seemed to be able to run a very impressive operation on behalf of the police department, had a police badge and a phony detective agency, and murdered upwards of 100 people and carved them up into meat and sold them as horse meat. And this case itself rebounded to the against the homosexual political movement in Berlin, I mean Germany in general, and was used again as fodder for the Nazis in their crusade against virtually anybody who disagreed with them.
And again, the homosexuality was identified also very cleverly by the Nazis with being Jewish, with being socialist or communist, with, in other words, any form of political activity and expression to the left at center, was successfully tarred as perverted, criminal, and so forth by the Nazis in considerable measure because of the Fritz Haarmann case, not only an apparent provocation, but one of the great overlooked elements in the development of the Third Reich. Now, we're going to continue with a book which is the mainstay of our broadcast this evening, a book called The Pink Triangle by Richard Plant. More about the Nazis and their attitudes towards homosexuals. Perhaps the Nazi Party's most explicit statement on homosexuality is the one it published on May 14, 1928, in response to a query about its stance toward reform of paragraph 175. It is worth quoting in full. "It is not necessary that you and I live, but it is necessary that the German people live. And it can only live if it can fight, for life means fighting. And it can only fight if it maintains its masculinity. It can only maintain its masculinity if it exercises discipline, especially in matters of love. Free love and deviance are undisciplined. Therefore, we reject you as we reject anything that hurts our nation. Anyone who thinks of homosexual love is our enemy. We reject anything which emasculates our people and makes it a plaything for our enemies, for we know that life is a fight, and it is madness to think that men will ever embrace fraternally. Natural history teaches us the opposite. Might makes right. The strong will always win over the weak. Let us see to it that we can once again become the strong. But this we can only achieve in one way. The German people must once again learn how to exercise discipline. We therefore reject any form of lewdness, especially homosexuality, because it robs us of our last chance to free our people from the bondage which now enslaves it." Despite these attacks, the effort to reform paragraph 175 continued, albeit fitfully, until the end of 1929, when the Nazis gained 107 seats in the Reichstag, making parliamentary reform impossible. On January 30, 1933, Hitler was named Chancellor of Germany. On February 23, pornography was banned, along with homosexual rights organizations. I think that last sentence in that timetable also we might repeat, because it also is similar to certain trends in today's society, today's contemporary America, basically. On January 30th, 1933, Hitler was named Chancellor of Germany. On February 23rd, pornography was banned along with homosexual rights organizations. Of course, one of the major foci, not only of the born-again Christians, but the Reagan administration and certain extremist elements in the women's movement, notably those grouped around Standartenfuhrer Andrea Dworkin, are pushing indeed for a ban of pornography. Neither Nip or I particularly endorses pornography, but the Nazi aversion to pornography, their subsequent subversion of free speech should be borne in mind here.
Right. "Because I was not a pornographer, I did not say anything when they came for the pornographers," etc., etc., etc.
Yes, indeed. As luck would have it, Hirschfeld was out of the country on a lecture trip. On March 7th, the SS burst into and searched Kurt Hiller's apartment. On March 23rd, he was arrested and packed off to the concentration camp at Oranienburg near Berlin. 9 months later, incredibly, he was released. He made his way first to Prague and then to London. Hitler's arrest and incarceration was the opening salvo in the Nazi campaign to rid Germany of its homosexuals. On May 6th, the full frenzy of hate was unleashed. The target? Hirschfeld's Institute of Sexual Science, condemned by the Nazis as, quote, "the international center of the white slave trade," unquote, and, quote, "an unparalleled breeding ground of dirt and filth." A band of about 100 young fanatics descended upon the Institute, smashing everything they could lay their hands on. They confiscated more than 12,000 books and the precious collection of photographs. 4 days later, in a public ceremony, these were burned. The crowd roared approval, especially after somebody threw in a bust of Hirschfeld. By the summer of 1933, Ernst Röhm's SA goons were raiding gay bars throughout Germany. Many were closed, but others didn't shutter their doors until 1935. That was the year when the campaign against homosexuals shifted into high gear, and the new Nazi laws banning such gathering places and outlawing homosexuals as sexual vagrants, unquote, went into effect. As for Hirschfeld, he died of heart failure on May 14, 1935, his 67th birthday, and incidentally 7 years to the day after that Nazi encyclical on homosexuality that we read just a couple of minutes ago. So again, Hitler assuming the chancellery on January 30th, not January 20th, February 23rd, pornography is banned. February 27th, the Reichstag burns. And 4 days before the Reichstag burns, homosexuality formally banned in Germany. All homosexual organizations, I should say. Homosexuality already was.
That again from the Miscellaneous Archive show, The Pink Triangle, in turn accessing Richard Plant's book of the same name, and also Paramilitary Politics in Weimar Germany by James Biehl, B-I-E-H-L. This was recorded on February 28th of 1988. We will be continuing with this analysis in our next program. This concludes For the Record program number 979, Nazism, Anti-Gay and Anti-Feminist Propaganda, and the Fritz Harman Incident. This is being recorded on October 10th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.